Desert God by Wilbur Smith. Read by Mike Grady. Artan blinked his little eyes that were set deep in their rolls of fat, and then raised them from the baleboard laid out between us. He turned his gaze on the two young princesses of the royal house of Tammuz, who were disporting themselves naked in the limpid water of the lagoon. "They are no longer children," he remarked casually, without a trace of lascivious interest in the subject. We sat facing each other under an open barazza, thatched with palm fronds, beside one of the lagoons in the backwaters of the great Nile River. I knew that his reference to the girls was an attempt to distract my attention from his next move of the balestones. Artan does not enjoy losing, so he is not overly scrupulous about how he wins. Artan has always been high on the list of my oldest and dearest friends. Like me, he is a eunuch, and was once a slave. During the period of his slavery, and long before he reached puberty, his master had singled him out for his exceptional intellect and his acute mental powers. He wished to nurture and concentrate those gifts, and prevent them from being diluted by the distractions of his libido. Artan was an extremely valuable property, and so his master employed the most renowned physician in Egypt to perform the castration. His master is long dead, but Artan has risen high above his slave status. He is now the chamberlain of the royal palace of Pharaoh at Thebes, but he is also a master of spies who administers a network of informers and clandestine agents across the civilized world. There is only one organization that exceeds his, and that is my own. In this, as in most things, we are in friendly competition with each other, and very little gives us greater pleasure and satisfaction than to score a coup, the one over the other. I enjoy his company immensely. He amuses and often surprises me with his good advice and perception. On occasion, he can test my skill on the baleboard. He is usually generous with his praise, but mostly he acts as a foil to my own genius. Now both of us studied Bekatha, who is the younger of the royal princesses by almost 2 years. Although you might not have guessed that fact, for she was tall for her age, and already her breasts were beginning to swell, and in the cool lagoon waters her nipples perked out jauntily. She was lithe, agile, and she laughed readily. On the other hand, she was possessed of a mercurial temper. Her features were nobly chiseled, her nose narrow and straight, her jaw strong and rounded, and her lips finely arched. Her hair was thick and sparkled with glints of copper in the sunlight. She had inherited that from her father. Although she had not yet shown the red flower of womanhood, I knew that her time was not far off. I love her, but truth to tell, I love her elder sister a shade better. Tahuti was the senior and more beautiful of the two sisters. Whenever I looked upon her, it seemed to me that I was seeing again her mother. Queen Lostris had been the one great love of my life. Yes, I had loved her as a man loves a woman. For unlike my friend Artan, I was gelded only after I had grown to full manhood and known the joy of a woman's body. True it is that my love for Queen Lostris was never consummated, for I was castrated before she was born. But it was all the more intense for never having been assuaged. I had nursed her as a child, and had shepherded her through her long and joyous life, counselling her and guiding her, giving all of myself to her without stinting. In the end, I held her in my arms as she died. Before she went on into the underworld, Lostris whispered to me something which I will never forget. "I have loved only two men in my life. You, Teta, were one of them." Those were the sweetest words I have ever heard spoken. I planned and supervised the building of her royal tomb, and laid her once beautiful but then wasted body in it, and I wished that I could go with her into the netherworld. However, I knew that I could not, for I had to stay and take care of her children, as I had cared for her. Truly, this has not been an onerous burden, for my life has been enriched by this sacred charge. At 16 years of age, Tehuti was already a woman fully fledged. Her skin was lustrous and unblemished, her arms and her legs were slim and elegant as those of a dancer, or the limbs of her father's great war bow, which I had carved for him, and which I had placed on the lid of his sarcophagus before I sealed his tomb. Tehuti's hips were full, but her waist was narrow as the neck of a wine jug. Her breasts were round and taut. The dense, golden curls that covered her head were a gleaming glory. Her eyes were as green as her mother's had been. She was lovely beyond the telling of it, and her smile wrung my heart whenever she turned it upon me. Her nature was gentle, slow to anger, but fearless and strong-willed once she was roused. I loved her almost as much as I still love her mother. "You have done well with them, Taita," Aton gave praise unstintingly. "They are the treasures which may yet save our very Egypt from the barbarian." In this, as with many other things, Aton and I were in full accord. This was the true reason why the two of us had come to this remote and secluded location. Although everyone else in the palace, including Pharaoh himself, was convinced that we had met here to continue our endless rivalry across the Baobab. I did not respond at once to his remark, but I dropped my eyes to the board. Aton had made his latest move while I was still watching the girls. He was the most skilled player of this sublime game in Egypt, which was as good as saying, in the civilized world. That is, excepting me, of course. I can usually best him in 3 games out of 4. Now, at a glance, I saw that this game would be one of my 3. His last move had been ill-considered. The layout of his stones was now unbalanced. It was one of the few flaws in his game that often, when he had convinced himself that victory was within his grasp, he threw caution to the winds and disregarded the rule of 7 stones. Then he tended to concentrate his full attack from his south castle and allowed me to wrest control of either the east or the west from him. This time it was the east. I did not need a second invitation. I struck like a cobra. He rocked back on his stool as he evaluated my surprise move, and when at last the sheer genius of it struck him, his face darkened with outrage and his voice choked. "I think that I hate you, Taita. And if I don't, then I certainly ought to do so." "I was lucky, old friend." I tried not to gloat. "Anyway, it's only a game." He puffed out his cheeks with indignation. "Of all the inane things I have ever heard you say, Taita, that is the most crass. It is not only a game. It is the veritable reason for living." He really was angry. I reached down under the table for the copper wine jug, and I refilled his cup. It was a superb wine, the very best in all of Egypt, which I had taken directly from the cellars beneath Pharaoh's palace. Aton puffed out his cheeks again and tried to bolster his anger and affront, but as of their own accord his plump fingers closed around the handle of his cup and he raised it to his lips. He swallowed twice, his eyes closed with pleasure. When he lowered the vessel, he sighed. "Ah, perhaps you're right, Taita. There are other good reasons for living." He began to pack the whale stones into their leather drawstring bags. "So, what do you hear from the north? Astonish me once again with the extent of your intelligence." We had come at last to the true purpose of this meeting. The north was always the danger. Over 100 years ago, mighty Egypt was split by treason and rebellion. The Red Pretender, the false Pharaoh, I deliberately do not speak his name, rather may it be cursed through all eternity, this traitor rebelled against the true Pharaoh and seized all the land to the north of Assyut. Our very Egypt was plunged into a century of civil war. Then, in his turn, the Red Pretender's heir was overwhelmed by a savage and warlike tribe that emerged from the northern steppes beyond the Sinai. These barbarians swept through Egypt, conquering all of it by means of a weapon which we had never known existed, the horse and chariot. Once they had defeated the Red Pretender and captured the northern part of Egypt, from the Middle Sea to Assyut, these Hyksos turned upon us in the south. We true Egyptians had no defense against them. We were driven from our own lands and were forced to retreat southwards beyond the cataracts of the Nile at Elephantine and into the wilderness at the end of the world. We languished there while my mistress, Queen Lostris, rebuilt our army. My part in this regeneration was not altogether insignificant. I am not by nature a boastful man. However, in this instance, I can state without fear of contradiction that without me to guide and counsel my mistress and her son, the Crown Prince Memnon, who is now the Pharaoh Thammuz, they would never have achieved their purpose. Among my numerous other services to her, I built the first chariots, with spoked wheels that were lighter and faster than those of the Hyksos, which had only solid wooden wheels. Then I found the horses to draw them. When we were ready, Pharaoh Thammuz, who had now grown to manhood, led our new army down again through the cataracts, northwards into Egypt. The leader of the Hyksos invaders called himself King Solytis, but he was no king. He was at the best only a robber baron and an outlaw. However, the army he commanded still outnumbered us Egyptians almost 2-1, and it was well equipped and ferocious. But we caught them off guard and, at Thebes, fought a mighty battle with them. We smashed their chariots and slaughtered their men. We sent them scurrying in rout back northwards. They left 10,000 corpses and 2,000 wrecked chariots on the battlefield. However, they inflicted heavy losses upon our gallant troops, so that we were unable to pursue and completely destroy them. Since then, the Hyksos have been skulking in the delta of the Nile. King Solytis, that old plunderer, is dead now. He did not die on the battlefield from a blow by a good Egyptian sword, as would have been just and proper. He died in bed of old age, surrounded by a horde of his hideous wives and their ghastly offspring. Amongst them was Bayon, his eldest son. This Bayon now calls himself King Bayon, Pharaoh of the upper and lower kingdoms of Egypt. The truth is, he is nothing but a freebooting killer, worse even than his evil father. My spies regularly report to me how Bayon is steadily rebuilding the Hyksos army, which we so grievously wounded at the Battle of Thebes. These reports are disturbing, because we are having great difficulty procuring the raw materials to make good the losses that we suffered in that same battle. Our landlocked southern kingdom is cut off from the great Middle Sea and from trade with the other civilized nations and city-states of the world, which are rich in leather, timber, copper, antimony, tin, and the other sinews of war which we lack. We are also short of manpower. We need allies. On the other hand, our enemies, the Hyksos, have fine harbours in the delta where the Nile enters the Middle Sea. Trade flows into these uninterrupted. I also know through my spies that the Hyksos are seeking to forge alliances with other warlike nations. Artan and I were meeting in this isolated spot to discuss and ponder these problems. The survival of our very Egypt was being held on the point of a dagger. Artan and I had on many occasions discussed all this at length, but now we were ready to make the final decisions to lay before Pharaoh. The royal princesses had other plans. They had seen Artan pick up the Baos stones and they took this as a signal that they were now able to command my full attention. I am devoted to them both, but they are very demanding. They charged out of the lagoon, splashing water in all directions, and raced each other to get to me first. Bekatha is the baby, but she is very quick and determined. She will do almost anything to obtain what she wants. She beat Tehuti by a length and dived into my lap, cold and wet, from the lagoon. "I love you, Tata," she cried as she threw her arms around my neck and pressed her sodden mop of red hair to my cheek. "Tell us a story, Tata." Bested in the race to reach me, Tehuti had to accept the less desirable position at my feet. Gracefully, she lowered her naked and dripping body to the ground and hugged my legs to her breast while she rested her chin on my knees and looked up into my face. "Yes, please, Tata. Tell us about our mama and how beautiful and clever she was." "I must speak to Uncle Arton first," I protested. "Oh, all right then, but don't be too long." Bekatha chipped in. "It's so boring."
"Not too long, I promise."
I looked back at Arton and switched smoothly into Hyksosian. Both of us are fluent in the language of our deadly enemy. I make it my business to know my enemy. I have a way with words and languages. I have had many years since the return to Thebes to learn. Arton had not joined the exodus to Nubia. He was not an adventurous soul, so he had remained in Egypt and had suffered under the Hyksos. However, he had learned everything they had to teach, including their language. Neither of the princesses understood a word of it.
"Oh, I hate it when you speak that dreadful jargon," Bekatha pouted, and Tehuti agreed with her. "If you love us, you will speak Egyptian, Taita."
I hugged Bekatha and stroked Tehuti's lovely head. Nevertheless, I continued to speak to Arton in the language that the girls so bitterly deplored. "Ignore the babbling of infants. Proceed, old friend." Arton smothered his grin and went on.
"So we are agreed then, Taita. We need allies, and we need trade with them. At the same time, we have to deny both of these to the Hyksos."
I was tempted to make a sarcastic reply, but I had already annoyed him enough across the bailboard, so I nodded seriously. "As usual, you have come to the point unerringly, and you have stated the problem succinctly. Allies and trade. Very well. What do we have to trade, Arton?"
"We have the gold from our mines in Nubia, which we discovered while we were in exile beyond the cataracts."
Arton had never left Egypt, but to hear him tell it, he might have been the one who led the exodus. I smiled inwardly, but maintained a serious expression as he went on.
"Although the yellow metal is not as valuable as silver, yet men also lust for it. With the quantities that Pharaoh has piled in his treasury, we can readily buy friends and allies."
I nodded in agreement, although I knew that the amount of Pharaoh's treasure was greatly overestimated by Arton and many like him who are not as close to the throne as I am. I went on to enlarge on the subject. "However, do not forget the produce of the rich black loam that Mother Nile casts up upon her banks with every annual inundation. Men must eat, Arton. The Cretans, the Sumerians, and the Hellenic city-states have little arable land. They are always hard-pressed to find corn to feed their people. We have corn in abundance," I reminded him.
"Aye, Tahita, we have corn, and we also have horses to trade. We breed the finest war horses in the world, and we have other things even more rare and precious."
Arton paused delicately, and he glanced at the lovely child I was cuddling and the other who sat at my knee. Nothing else needed to be said on this subject. The Cretans and the Sumerians of the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers were our nearest and most powerful neighbors. Both of these people tended to be swarthy and sable-haired. Their rulers fined the fair-haired
and light-skinned women of the Aegean tribes and of the royal house of Egypt desirable. However, the pale and insipid Hellenic women cannot stand comparison with our glowing Nilotic jewels. The parents of my two princesses were Tanis, he of the fiery red curls, and the bright blonde Queen Lostris. They had bred true, and the beauty of their two girls was becoming renowned across the entire world. Ambassadors from afar had already made the onerous journeys across wide deserts and deep waters to the palace of Thebes to convey delicately to Pharaoh Thammuz the interests of their masters in making a marital and martial alliance with the house of Thammuz. The Sumerian King Nimrod and the supreme Minos of Crete were two of those who had sent envoys. At my behest, Pharaoh had received both these ambassadors kindly. He had accepted the handsome gifts of silver and cedar wood that they presented. Then he had listened sympathetically to their offers of marriage to one or both of Thammuz's sisters. But then Pharaoh had explained that the two girls were still too young to contract a marriage, and that they should speak again on this subject after both girls had reached maturity. That had been some time ago, and now circumstances had changed. At the time, Pharaoh had discussed with me the possible alliance between Egypt and Sumeria or Crete. I had tactfully pointed out to him that Crete would make a more desirable ally than would the Sumerians. Firstly, the Sumerians were not a seafaring race, and although they could field a powerful army, well equipped with cavalry and chariots, they did not possess a navy of any distinction. I reminded Pharaoh that our southern Egypt had no access to the Middle Sea. Our Hyksos enemies controlled the northern reaches of the Nile, and we were essentially a landlocked country. The Sumerians had also limited access to the sea, and their fleet was puny compared to those of other nations, such as the Cretans or even the Mauritanian people in the west. The Sumerians were always reluctant to risk the sea passage with heavily laden ships. They feared both the pirates and the turbulent weather. The overland route between our countries was also fraught with difficulties. The Hyksos controlled the isthmus that runs between the Middle and Red Seas and connects Egypt to the Sinai Desert in the north. The Sumerians would be forced to march across the Sinai Desert much further south and then take ship across the Red Sea to reach us. This route would present so many problems to their army, not least the lack of water and the dearth of shipping on the Red Sea, that it might prove to be impossible. What I had previously proposed to Pharaoh, and which I now outlined for Aton, was a treaty between our very Egypt and the Supreme Minos of Crete. The Supreme Minos was the title of the Cretan hereditary ruler. He was the equivalent of our Pharaoh. To suggest that he was more powerful than our own Pharaoh would be treason. Suffice it to say that his fleet was reputed to comprise over 10,000 fighting and trading galleys, of such an advanced design that no other ship could outrun them or outfight them. We have what the Cretans want, corn, gold, and lovely brides. The Cretans have what we need, the most formidable fleet of fighting ships in existence, with which to blockade the Hyksos ports in the mouth of the Nile Delta, and in which to convoy the Sumerian army down the southern slopes of the Middle Sea, and thus catch the Hyksos in a deadly pincer movement, which would crush their army between our forces.
"A fine plan," Aton applauded me. "An almost infallible plan, except for one small, almost insignificant detail which you have overlooked, Taita, my old darling." He was grinning slyly, savouring his revenge for the drubbing I had just given him on the bail board. I have never been a vindictive person, but in this instance I could not restrain myself from having a little bit more innocent fun at Aton's expense. I contrived an expression of dismay. "Oh, don't tell me that, please. I have thought it all out so carefully. Where is the fault in my plan?"
"You're too late.
The Supreme Minos of Crete has already contracted a secret alliance with King Bayon of the Hyksos." Aton smacked his lips and slapped one of his own elephantine thighs
gleefully. He had confuted my proposition decisively, or so he believed.
"Oh, yes," I replied.
"I presume that you are referring to the trading fort to deal with Bayon that the Cretans opened 5 moons ago at Tamiat, the most easterly mouth of Mother Nile in the Delta." Now it was Aton's turn to look crestfallen. "When did you learn about that? How did you know?"
"Please, Aton," I spread my hands in a gesture of appeal. "You do not expect me to reveal all my sources, do you?"
Aton recovered his poise swiftly.
"The Supreme Minos and Bayon already have an understanding, if not a war alliance. Clever as we all know you are, Taita, there is very little you can do about it."
"What if Bayon is planning treachery?" I asked mysteriously, and he gawked at me.
"Treachery? I do not understand, Taita. What form would this treachery take?
Do you have any inkling of how much silver the Supreme Minos of Crete is hoarding in this new fortress at Tamiat, in Hyksos territory, Aton?"
"I imagine it must be substantial. If the Supreme Minos proposes to buy the greater part of next season's corn crop from Bayon, then he would need to have a heavy weight of silver on hand,"
Aton hazarded carefully.
"Perhaps as much as 10 or even 20 lakhs.
"You are very perceptive, my dear friend. However, you have stated but a small part of the problems that face the Supreme Minos. He dare not risk sending his heavily laden treasure ships to cross the open seas during the season of storms, so for 5 months of the year he cannot send bullion to the southern shores of the Middle Sea, which in winter entails a voyage of more than 500 leagues from his island." Aton broke in quickly, trying to beat me to my conclusion.
"Ah, yes, indeed, I take your point. So that means that for all that period of time, the Supreme Minos is unable to trade with the states and nations that lie upon this African shore of the Great Sea."
"During the whole of winter, half of the world is closed to him," I agreed. "But if he could obtain a secure base along the Egyptian coast, his fleet would be protected from the winter gales. Then, all year round, his ships would be able to ply their trade from Mesopotamia to Mauritania under the protecting lee of the land." I paused to let him see the full magnitude of what the Supreme Minos was planning, and then I went on remorselessly. 20 lakhs of silver would not be sufficient to fund 1/100th part of this activity. 500 lakhs is a more likely amount that he will have to hoard in his new fortress at Tamiat to carry his trade through the winter. Do you not agree? That amount of silver would make any man contemplate treachery, more especially such a naturally perfidious and rapacious rogue as Bayon. For 50 heartbeats, Aton was struck dumb by the magnitude of the vision that I had presented him with. When at last he stirred again, his voice croaked as he asked,
"So you have proof that Bayon, in defiance of his incipient treaty with the Supreme Minos, is planning to storm the Tamiat fortress and seize the Supreme Minos treasure? Is that what you are telling me, Taita?"
"I did not say that I have proof that it is Bayon's intention to do so. I merely asked you a question. I did not make a statement." I chuckled at his confusion. It was unkind of me, but I could not restrain myself. Never in our long acquaintance have I seen him so lost for rebuttal or repartee. Then I took pity on him. "You and I both know that Bayon is a savage oaf, Aton. He can drive a chariot, swing a sword, draw a bow or sack a city. However, I doubt he is able to plan a visit to the privy without ponderous and painful deliberation."
"Then who is it that is planning this raid upon the Supreme Minos treasury?" Aton demanded.
Instead of answering him immediately, I merely sat back on my stool and smiled. He stared at me. Then his expression cleared.
"You? Surely not,
tighter. How can you plan to rob the Supreme Minos of 500 lakhs of silver and then court the Cretan for his support and alliance?
In the darkness, it is difficult to tell a Hyksos from an Egyptian, especially if the Egyptian is dressed in Hyksos war array and carrying Hyksos weapons and speaking Hyksosian, I pointed out, and he shook his head once again at a loss for words. I pressed him further. You do agree that such a treacherous attack would destroy forever any chances of Crete and Hyksos ever forming an alliance against us? Artan smiled at last.
You are so full of guile, Taita, that I wonder how I can ever trust you.
Then he demanded,
just how large is the Cretan garrison at Tamiat?
At the present time, it comprises nearly 2,000 soldiers and archers, although almost all of these are mercenaries.
So?
He was impressed. He paused again, and then continued,
how many men would you need, or should I ask, rather, how many men would Bayon need to carry through this dastardly plan?
Enough, I hedged. I would not reveal all my plans to Artan. He accepted that and did not press me directly. However, he asked another oblique question.
You would leave no Cretan survivors in the Tamiat fort? You would slaughter them all?
Of course, I would allow the great majority of them to escape, I contradicted him firmly. I want as many of them as possible to make their way back to Crete to warn the Supreme Minos of King Bayon's treachery.
The Cretan treasure? Artan demanded. These 500 lakhs of silver. What will become of that?
Pharaoh's coffers are almost empty. We cannot save Egypt without treasure.
Who will command this raid? He demanded. Will you do it, Taita?
I looked aghast. You know that I am no warrior, Artan. I am a physician, a poet, and a gentle philosopher. However, if Pharaoh urges me to do so, I am willing to accompany the expedition as an advisor to the commanding officer.
Who will command, then? Will it be Kratos?
I love Kratos, and he is a fine soldier. But he is old, bull-headed, and not amenable to reason or suggestion. I shrugged, and Artan chuckled.
You have described General Kratos perfectly, O gentle bard. If not him, then, whom will Pharaoh appoint?
He will probably appoint Zaras.
Ah, the famous Captain Zaras of the Blue Crocodile Division of the Royal Guards. One of your favourites, Taita, not so?
I ignored the taunt. I have no favourites. On occasion, even I can stretch the truth just a little. But Zaras is simply the best man for the job, I responded mildly. When I laid before Pharaoh my plan to discredit King Bayon with the Supreme Minos of Crete and to drive a wedge of steel between the two powers, which were potentially the most dangerous enemies we had in all the world, he was amazed at the brilliant simplicity of my design. I had begged for a private interview with Pharaoh, and of course he had granted it without a quibble. He and I were alone on the wide palm-lined terrace which encircled his throne room, overlooking the Nile at its widest point in southern Egypt. Of course, beyond Assyut, the river becomes wider and the current slower as it passes through the territory that the Hyksos have seized from us and flows down into the delta before debouching into the Middle Sea. There were sentries at both ends of the terrace to ensure that we could not be overlooked or overheard by either friend or enemy. The guards were under the direct command of reliable officers, but they kept discreetly out of sight, so Pharaoh and I were not distracted. We paced along the marble paving. Only now that we were alone was it permissible for me to walk shoulder to shoulder with him, even though I had been intimately involved with him from the minute of his birth. In truth, it was I who had delivered him into this world. I had been the one who caught his infant body in my hands as Queen Lostris propelled him from her royal womb, with the force of a stone from a slingshot. The very first act the prince ever performed was to empty his bladder over me.
I smiled now at the memory. I have been his tutor and his mentor since that day. I was the one who taught him to wipe his own arse, to read and write, to shoot a bow and drive a war chariot. From me he has learned how to rule a nation. Now at last he has grown into a fine young man, a doughty warrior, and the seasoned ruler of this very Egypt. But we are still the very best of friends. I would go so far as to say that Pharaoh loves me like the father he never knew, and I love him like the son I never had. Now, as he listened to the stratagem that I was proposing, he stopped walking and turned to face me with mounting wonder. When I reached the denouement of my plan, he seized my shoulders in hands that were hard and strong as bronze, from swinging a sword, drawing a bow, and driving a team of four horses in the traces of a chariot. "Tata, you old scallywag!" he shouted into my face. "You never fail to amaze me. Only you could have dreamed up such an outrageous plot. We must begin at once to plan the finer details. Well, I remember how I hated it when you forced me to learn to speak Hyksosian. Now I would be lost without it. I could never have commanded this expedition without being able to pass as one of our enemies." It took me several hours of tactful manipulation before I could convince him that the danger of leaving Egypt without a leader at such a crucial point in our history far outweighed the glory or other benefit that he could hope to win from a successful capture of the Minoan fortress at Tamiat and the treasure it contained. I gave thanks to Horus that he is young enough to be flexible in his thinking and old enough to have learned a modicum of good sense. Long ago I learned how to sway him to my purpose without allowing him to realize that I was doing so. In the end, I usually have my own way. At my suggestion, Pharaoh appointed Zaras to command the expedition. Even though Zaras was young, only 25 years of age, almost the same age as Pharaoh himself, he had already made a considerable name for himself, as his military rank attested. I had worked with him many times before, and I knew that his reputation was well-founded. Most important was the fact that he revered me. However, before he dismissed me, Pharaoh Tammuz placed in my hands the royal hawk seal. This was Pharaoh's means of delegating all of his powers to the bearer. The bearer of the seal answered only to Pharaoh. On pain of death, no man could question or hinder him in the course or commission of the royal duties. It was customary for Pharaoh to bestow the hawk seal upon his chosen emissary with solemn ceremony in the presence of senior members of his court. But I realized that in such a sensitive matter as this, he had decided to do so in total secrecy. Nevertheless, I was humbled by the trust he had shown in me. I fell to my knees and touched my forehead to the ground before him. But Pharaoh stooped and lifted me to my feet. "You've never failed me, Taita." He embraced me. "I know you will not do so now." I went directly to find Zaras. I impressed upon him the importance of our mission and the opportunity it presented to him to establish himself in Pharaoh's esteem. Success in this mission would set his feet firmly on the high road to advancement and royal favour. He tried unconvincingly to hide his awe from me. The two of us drew up a list of 220 men to make up the raiding party. At first, Zaras was adamant that this number was insufficient to take on the Cretan garrison of almost 2,000. When I explained the particular circumstances, which I had not shared with Aton or even with Pharaoh, he accepted my plan in its entirety. I allowed him to choose his own men. I insisted only that the single attribute all the men he selected must possess was the ability to speak Hyksosian fluently. Zaras was too young to have been part of the exodus to Nubia when the Hyksos overwhelmed southern Egypt. In fact, he had been pressed into the Hyksos legions at the age of 16. The result was that he could speak the language as though born to it, and he could pass for one of them in any circumstances. However, he was a loyal Egyptian and had been amongst the very first to revert to his true race when Pharaoh Tammuz led us down through the cataracts to thrash the Hyksos at the Battle of Thebes and drive their survivors in panic and confusion back into the north. The men Zara selected to make up the raiding party were highly trained and drilled, mostly under Zaros himself. They were all sailors as well as soldiers, and had spent most of their time as fighting crews on board the river galleys when they were not handling the war chariots. There was nothing more that Zaros needed to teach them. I told him to divide this force into small detachments, each of 15 or 20 men, so that they would not draw too much attention to themselves when they left the city of Thebes. When I showed the royal hawk seal to the captain of the guard at the city gates, he did not question me. Over 3 successive nights, these small bands of Zaras men slipped out of the city during the hours of darkness and headed out into the eastern wilderness. They reassembled in the ruins of the ancient city of Akita, where I was waiting for them. I had with me wagons laden with authentic Hyksos helmets, armor, uniforms, and weapons. This was just a small part of the booty we had captured from the enemy at the Battle of Thebes. From Akita, we marched on eastwards to the shores of the Gulf of Suez at the northern end of the Red Sea. The men wore Bedouin robes over their uniforms and weapons. Zaras and I had ridden ahead of the main party. We were waiting at the little fishing village of Al Nadas on the shore of the Gulf when they caught up with us. Zaras had hired a guide, whom he had employed before, and whom he recommended highly. His name was Al Namju. He was a tall, silent man with one eye. He was waiting for us at Al Nadas. Al Namju had chartered all the available fishing vessels from the villagers to ferry us across to the eastern shore. The gulf was less than 20 leagues wide at this point, and we could see the low hills of the Sinai on the far side. We crossed in the night, with only the stars to light our way. We disembarked on the eastern shore of the gulf near another tiny fishing village. This was Zuba, where one of Al Namju's sons was waiting for us. He had a string of over 100 donkeys, which he had hired to carry our heavy gear. We still faced a march of almost 200 leagues northwards to reach the Middle Sea. But the men were trained to peak condition, and we moved fast. Al Namju kept well to the east of the Sinai Isthmus, which links Africa to Asia to minimize the risk of us encountering any Hyksos troops. Finally, we came out on the rocky southern coast of the Middle Sea, near the Phoenician port of Ushu. This was approximately midway between the Sumerian border and that part of northern Egypt still in the hands of the Hyksos invaders. I left Zaras and his men encamped outside the port and went ahead with 2 donkeys loaded with gold ingots concealed in leather sacks of corn, and 4 picked men to help me. After 3 days of bargaining with the merchants of the port, I had 3 medium-sized galleys drawn up on the beach below the Phoenician temple of Melkart. Each of these ships was capable of carrying 100 men. They had cost me dearly, and there was very little gold remaining in the corn sacks we had brought with us from Thebes. I let it be known in the port that we were a band of mercenaries travelling eastwards to sell our services to the Assyrian king Al-Hattur, who was laying siege to the city of Biryat. As soon as the men were embarked, we shoved off from the beach. When we reached deep water, and while we were still visible to the watchers in Ushu, we turned and rowed eastwards towards Lebanon. However, once we were out of sight of land, I reversed our course and headed back towards Egypt and the delta of the Nile. There was a light offshore breeze blowing that favoured us. We hoisted the mainsails and relieved the rowers of the long oars at regular intervals. We passed Ushu once again, but heading in the opposite direction. I kept our ships below the horizon and out of sight of the port. Although each galley was crowded with 70 men or more, we made good speed, and there was curling white water under the bows of every vessel. By late afternoon of the second day, I calculated that the Cretan fortress of Tamiat lay less than 100 leagues ahead of us. Of course, I was in the leading galley with Zaras, and I suggested to him that as we left Ushu far behind us, we could now close in and keep within sight of the shore. It was much easier for me to navigate and judge our position when I had sight of solid land to guide me. At last, as the sun touched the surface of the sea ahead of us and the darkness gathered behind us, I pointed out to the helmsman a sheltered but deserted bay with sandy beaches. We ran in until our keels grounded, and then the men jumped overboard and dragged the boats up the sand. The journey from Thebes to where we now lay had been long and grueling, but we were within a few leagues of our goal. There was a contagious sense of excitement and anticipation in our camp that evening, tempered by the foreboding which even the bravest men feel on the eve of battle. Zaras had selected 2 of his best men to command our other galleys. The first of these was named Dilbar. He was a tall and handsome man, with muscled forearms and powerful hands. From our first meeting, he had particularly engaged my attention and earned my approval. His eyes were dark and piercing, but he had a glossy pink scar from a sword cut across his right cheek. This detracted not in the least from his good looks. When he gave an order, the men responded to him readily and swiftly. The commander of the third galley was a stocky man with broad shoulders and a bull neck. His name was Akimi. He was a jovial man with a bull voice and an infectious laugh. His weapon of choice was a long-handled axe. Akimi was the one who came to me after the men had eaten. "My lord Taita," he saluted me. When first the men had used the title, I had protested mildly that I was not entitled to it. They had ignored my protestations, and I did not persist. "The men have asked me if you will do them the honour of singing for them tonight." I have an exceptional voice, and under my fingers the lute becomes a celestial object. I can seldom find it within me to deny entreaties of this kind.